fact, instead of ending it, they're filing lawsuits, for example, against California for passing their own laws against private detention centers, which it was done by Trump, but once Biden came in, didn't stop that lawsuit. They actually continue the lawsuit against California for this legislation against private detention centers. So in one hand, we have really good results that we're still fighting for. And on the other hand, they have not delivered what they promised.
Well, thanks so much for the amazing work. We look forward to hearing about when this draconian dungeon gets closed down, as well as the rest of them all over the United States, and hopefully the world too. And we hope people support the organization. Make sure you check out laresistencianw.org. That's the website, laresistencianw.org. For more information, how you can support the organization, get plugged in, help out, and listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. So much thanks, Madhu, for being with us again. And we'll hope to have you again soon. And special thanks to Prison Pipeline collective member Karen James for post-production.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
You know, this idea of purity and you're never compromised and you're always politically woke and all that stuff, you should get over that quickly. The world is messy. There are ambiguities. Yep. People who do really good stuff have flaws. People who you are fighting may love their kids and, you know, share certain things with you. And I think that one danger I see among young people, particularly on college campuses, Malia and I talk about this, but I do get a sense sometimes now among certain young people, and this is accelerated by social media, there is this sense sometimes of the way of me making change is to be as judgmental as possible about other people. And that's enough. Like if I tweet or hashtag about how you didn't do something right or used the word wrong verb, or then I can sit back and feel pretty good about myself because, man, you see how woke I was? I called you out. That's not activism. That's not bringing about change. You know, if all you're doing is casting stones, you know, you're probably not going to get that far. That's easy to do.
Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. I'm Nia Gray, co-hosting this segment on the national backlash against America's racial reckoning. Is conservative messaging putting woke to sleep? We asked our panel three questions. The first question, The term woke is being used as a negative pejorative, expressing contempt. In less than 1 year, is this a cultural backlash against America's racial reckoning?
Cecil, question one, cultural backlash against America's racial reckoning. How do you feel about that question? Do you think it's happening? And if so, why?
I think it's happening, but I also want us to be aware of the fact that this continues to happen in our history, that whenever there seems to be a step forward, there is a reaction. And I found it helpful, some of the articles I read this week reminded me that this happens whenever progress is made. So the Republicans have a habit, if we look just at the last 50 years, of making cultural war. So whether it is in the 60s forced busing or in the 70s and 80s, affirmative action or outside agitators, these are all terms that are used as buzzwords to awaken their sleeping giant. And that is what they don't want to talk about by banning books in school, systemic injustice in our society, and how racism continues to be as American as cherry pie.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our topic is the national backlash against America's racial reckoning. Is conservative messaging putting woke to sleep?
What strikes me in the conversation about woke or wokeism is that it's an example of how language gets weaponized. And it's sort of the worst form of cultural appropriation because the term really came from Black culture, and they not only appropriated it, they redefined what it is. And now it represents these negatives, this cancel culture. They're, you know, connecting things that were never intended in the definition of what woke is, which was to be aware, you know, to be involved. I really have to give the conservative part of the country credit for being able to switch the narrative very effectively. So now being woke is a negative, where before it was a positive. And I think that connecting it with cancel culture, we see cancel culture on both sides, but the side that it's attached to is the progressive political side. I find that we need to figure out a way to address these misrepresentations.
The word woke, when used as a political term, refers to a perceived awareness of issues concerning social justice and racial equality, according to Wikipedia's entry on the subject. The article further reports that this use originated in the United States and derives from the African-American vernacular English expression, stay woke, the form of which conveys a continuing awareness of these issues. The Oxford English Dictionary defines woke as alert to injustice in society, especially racism. The Cambridge English Dictionary defines woke as aware, especially of social problems such as racism and inequality. Over time, however, the meaning of woke has shifted so that the word has come to suggest a sarcastic version of what it originally meant. Indeed, according to the Urban Dictionary, woke means the state of being pretentious about how much you care about a social issue. Those who would broadly consider themselves woke have been criticized for their sending of occasional Twitter tweets calling for social and racial justice, but never making concrete efforts toward affecting lasting change. To summarize, some people say that being woke indicates awareness of social issues, while others deploy the term as an insult.
Althea, the term woke came from your generation.
What's up with that?
I would amplify what Cecil and Diane said here. And, you know, woke is a more newly coined term, came into vogue, I believe, on Black Twitter in like 2014, and has since been extrapolated to sort of hint at a whole bunch of different ideas, but not connect them outright, right? This is what happens when mass culture sucks up and culturally appropriates a word. And for conservatives, that vagueness, the idea of what it might mean, because obviously to white Americans, wokeness is less obvious, it's not a problem that it seems vague from that perspective. It's a feature, because conservatives can gin up, you know, outrage around it. And what I want to connect this to is that this idea that Republicans and conservatives are very good at branding, and to the extent that it's been quantified and studied in opinion surveys, where they'll ask folks, hey, what do you think about this idea? What do you think about, you know, universal health care, X, Y, and Z type of social programs? Those programs, facially, when the majority of Americans consider them, that is agreeable to them. And those are, by and large, things that fall more in the Democrats' camp. Left-wing, liberal, progressive policies are more agreeable to the majority of Americans. But what conservatives are so good at doing, and they have been doing so well for so long, is putting the mean label on it, connecting it to scare tactics, and extrapolating it and creating an abstract version of it that it can sell to its base as being something that is not just not beneficial to them, but ultimately detrimental to their way of life. So it makes it scary, and it makes it something that's much more easily consumable. But I think what's important to notice when we're talking about woke and all the things that it might imply is that those core ideas of, you know, human rights, justice, treating people fairly, are not necessarily facially abhorrent to people. But the conservatives have done a good job of making it seem that way, because, you know, what conservatives are standing on their platform, if they say it with truth, with what they really are after, people do not necessarily agree with that. So what they will present themselves as is that they, what do they stand for? They stand against whatever the Democrats and the progressives are trying to do. I don't know what I'm doing, but I know what they're doing is wrong.
Thank you, Althea. Mary Lee, please.
This is part of a discussion that we've had a number of times together about where the left, progressives, whoever we are, and our lack of ability to strategize effectively as we are speaking to the community and the people of this nation that we're trying to organize or have a relationship with. When you look at the way in which the right has taken these terms, it's brilliant. And I see this as part of a continuum, right? So we've got this, you know, this language, woke, critical race theory. We have not been clear enough in our conversations about what it is and what it isn't. And so, Althea, as you say, it is very, it's sort of the tabula rasa for the right to come in and say, did you know that this is what this means? And then you see a through line to local school board races and elections. We here in Oregon just had a local school superintendent fired by a 4-3 majority of conservative activists who got themselves elected to the school board. And he was fired without cause because he was not implementing, to their satisfaction, a racist, misogynist, you know, anti-everyone policy that was meant to silence Black Lives Matter, queer pride, and other expressions that young people were bringing into the school that related to their own lived experience. And they were he was fired because of this infiltration. And there's a very explicit strategy to do that. And then there's another amplification of the woke, the critical race theory, all of the things that we've been talking about, and that gets leveraged and leveraged and leveraged and leveraged until you see, you know, on the national, on states elections and on the national election stage, this ground that has been incredibly tilled and softened and made ready for this kind of strategy to come forward. And there's nothing like that that I can see. And again, I'll admit my ignorance, that we are doing effectively on the left or with progressive people. I also want to speak really specifically to this issue of cultural appropriation. I did not use the term woke. Partially that's because I'm not as young, hip, and alive as some. But also, there is an implication for me, particularly as a Chinese American woman, of cultural appropriation of African American culture, practice, analysis, music, that I think we particularly have to understand, because so many things come out of African American culture that basically get fished, right? This concept of blackfishing by others who think it's cool or they want to act as if, without any understanding or commitment to the flip side of what happens to be African American in this culture and in this community that has to deal with the violence, the lack of opportunity, the lack of space to live, et cetera, et cetera. And what I think is particularly unfortunate about that is, so we've appropriated the term, and by we, I mean whoever's using it, and largely maybe white liberal activists, and now it's being turned against us, and we're upset about it. So where's that go? What do we do about that, right? Where do we find ourselves in an anti-Black environment or situation where we thought we were being woke and young and hip and alive, and now the very term that we appropriated from someone else has been appropriated from us in order to be used against us? And so I just want to think about that cycle and think about that that experience. We might learn something from that. My answer is yes and yes. It is absolutely a fading of white allyship, and it is also a reflection of anti-Blackness, that we see this dominionization of people's commitment. I want to share some statistics with you that were from an NPR poll and I'm trying to think about the second poll, and an Economist poll. So this was a year ago, right? Right when we were in the depth of it. So in 2016, 25% of white Americans surveyed said that the police were more likely to use excessive force against Black people. In 2020, as we had our uprisings, that number was 49%. So almost double white Americans understood that there might be more likely aggressive force against Black people, right? So that's good. Awareness was raised. People started to listen and think about things. And in the same poll, 45% of white people surveyed said they found racism to be a big problem. Those are both numbers that we want to see moving in those directions. 3 months later, in August and September, that number had fallen to 38%. Now, that number has fallen even further. So for me, 3 months later, that, you know, when the heat kind of ended and think, you know, here in Portland, it didn't end quickly, but, you know, the focus and the urgency started to lessen, white understanding of police brutality and racism as a problem in this country had already begun to fall back to pre-uprising levels. I think that speaks to our inability to, you know, focus for any period of time on anything that challenges our worldview or calls out a white supremacy culture in which we all live. And it's this problem that I think we've got to address ourselves to as activists and organizers and advocates in order to catch up to the right, and more importantly, in order to move forward on this agenda that is so critical to us. When you look at the data, it's very stark, and I haven't seen more recent data, you know, within the last 3 months here now, but I would not be surprised if we started to see exactly the kinds of percents we saw in 2016, and also perhaps more backlash, where people now are saying there's too much talk about it, there's too much focus about it, people are making too much of this this topic. So I think that that's a part of this conversation. You know, when the ACLU is portraying that 1 in 3 Black boys will be in prison at least once in their lifetime, I just, I just take a moment to pause there. That statistic is known and lived in many of our communities. I don't think people, white folks in the majority, know and understand what that means. Is look at three young African-American men, young men, and one of them, at least one of them, will be in prison at least once in their lifetime. What does that do to the fabric of the community? What does that do to the ability of the community to be able to be whole and to be able to be happy and to be able to be self-sufficient? So I think it absolutely is is backlash, and it absolutely is anti-blackness raising its head again.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on, let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things that about things that make me. Let's talk about race. Let's talk about race. Talk about race.
Has white allyship faded, or are we seeing a backlash to Black Lives Matter? I am a student of history and a student of social movements. So when I look at what has happened in the United States in the last year and a half, I compare it to other cycles in our history. There have been movements among those who have been oppressed, and a part of that movement is bringing in allies, and that works very well for a while. But then we realize those who are oppressed, that white allyship may fade. Martin Luther King, in that piece that many of us had to read while we were in school, A Letter from a Birmingham Jail, critique white allies or those who were on the side of the civil rights movement. And what Dr. King said in that letter was that those who were allies have a tendency to fade away, and that the harm that they do to the movement was as harmful as the KKK, in that the failure of allies to stay in the struggle hampered the movement from moving on. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't seek allies and work with allies, but it also means, and maybe I'm just an old cynic, is that what do we do when they fade away? It doesn't mean that the injustice has faded away. It doesn't mean that we struggle against the unjust justice system. It doesn't mean that our attempt to find adequate housing has faded away or we no longer need that. It doesn't mean that those who are facing hardship and the cruel backlash from our system will suddenly fade away. I think it means that we have to recognize the strength we have within our community, welcome those who come in, encourage them, but also recognize that unless you are a recipient of the harm, you may not realize how important it is to struggle against it. And even if you're not, you must realize that it is a difficult struggle and that not all people are prepared for it. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue to struggle and that people who have faded away will not benefit when we triumph. But we have to be aware of the limitations, and we must be strong enough to be able to endure when those who are with us for a moment have to go back to their less painful lives.
Ooh, that's deep. Althea.
To the question of whether white allyship has faded or its backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement, I would agree. I think that it is some of both. The work of major change that so many over the past year or so, mostly white folks, have become present to the fact that is necessary, it's a lot longer work than I think a lot of folks realize. And people who've been in organizing and in movements for a really long time know how hard fought and hard won the victories that have happened so far are. And being in the streets makes a big difference. Protest movements make a big difference, but so does sitting in bureaucratic meetings and working within the community and making connections. So as much as there are big things that need doing, there's a zillion smaller actions that need to change in order for the change that folks are looking for to be realized. Because that work is long, it is easy to be fatigued, it is easy to be disillusioned. And for white allies who do not have to, they have the opportunity to walk away. They are not directly impacted in the same way by systemically oppressive systems. That is why you see white allyship waning, because they can walk away, because the work is long and requires endurance that many people are not aware that they need to procure if they are committed to the work. And as far as the backlash to Black Lives Matter, we are definitely seeing that, of course, in a rhetorical sense in conservative media, but also on a local level at your local school board meeting. That's where we're seeing backlash to Black Lives Matter, not just in debates about critical race theory, which we've discussed on this show before, but also to even an open display of support for Black Lives Matter. Mary Lee mentioned this. There's a school district in Oregon that has been working to ban Black Lives Matter and pride flags from being displayed by anyone in school, and have taken extreme actions to defend this unconstitutional action. They're going to spend so much money on lawyers fighting this, but that is the culture war that conservatives have decided to wage, and where it's happening is on a local level.
Thank you, Althea. Professor Johnson, you also lost a school superintendent recently because there was an allegation that he was teaching critical race theory to a bunch of middle school age kids in Texas.
We did. First, the notion of, or the question of, whether we, Black Lives Matter, in that, and the movement is really losing white allyship. I think Mary Lee's statistics really give us a good visual that this happened, and this happened very fast. We are a nation of headlines. And the momentum that happened after the killing of George Floyd kept people, you know, they were there, they were highly charged, it was in front of everybody on the news. But we can see that interest didn't, you know, doesn't continue. So we did continue to have protests. But if you look at some of those statistics, it shows that the real fall in involvement with Black Lives Matter, with the legitimacy of Black Lives Matter, happened with white people, not with Black people. Black people supported and continued to believe in Black Lives Matter. So this change was really in the white allies. It is difficult to take the energy, the highly charged group that formed around Black Lives Matter when these horrific events occurred and translate it into something that's actionable for people. It's more difficult to say, I'm still committed to this. I can be in the street with a sign for a day or two, but if you're asking me where I need to lobby my senator and my congressman, and I need to have meetings, community meetings, to keep this going. There isn't a clear way to do that. And that causes people to move on and to lose interest and to disengage.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our topic is the national backlash against America's racial reckoning. Is conservative messaging putting woke to sleep?
Come on, let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Defund the police. Was this the correct tagline to promote police reform in America? Defund the police was the headline. Where is it now? And how has it impacted the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think the segue I would make into the piece around defund the police, I think you have to look at that recent vote in Minneapolis, where in the place where George Floyd was murdered, and the most energy arguably was there in that place, and there was legislation about how to defund the police, that and again, I can say that bill maybe wasn't clear enough, or we hadn't had enough conversation about what we meant by those words. Again, this issue of language, what do we mean and how might we be communicating and clear with each other? Another example where I believe we have not been clear enough with each other, have not communicated well enough with each other. And if we can't do that with each other, we will not do that with the other communities that we are trying to educate and invite into this work and this reimagining of the world. Well, that ballot measure was defeated. And now people are sort of left with, well, now what? What are we going to do? And I think there's been a basic misunderstanding. Many communities of color were never advocating for defunding the police, getting rid of the police. It was a conversation of, is police the only investment in our community? Are the police that are coming into our community racially unjust? The answer being yes. And we'd like to have the police not to kill us, right? Those were some of the qualities of defund the police. I think also we have to understand that the police state directly came out of enslaved people and the posses that were made to recapture enslaved people as they tried to escape and bring them back to their owners. So as we understand how the police state, the genesis of the police state and how it has moved forward, we might have an understanding about what might be different in a word that says defund the police, or an expression that says defund the police. When I hear people talk about it, it's not get rid of the police, it's invest in the things that help make people whole. Invest in the things that will prevent one third of our young men from being incarcerated. Invest in the things that will give us an ability to heat and eat and sleep consecutive or concurrently, not consecutively. There was a recent study here in Multnomah County about the connection between the number of police and the rate of crime. And what this study did, and again, it wasn't some big fancy study, it was people who were interested, but they went back and they used the police bureau's own data, and they found virtually none, very insignificant correlation, if any at all, between the size of sworn officers, the number of police, and the rate of crime. And moreover, the size of the budget for the police bureau did not equate itself to more police officers. So those are two really important statistics that I think we have to interrogate and include in this conversation that says defund the police. A bigger police budget does not translate to more police officers, if that's what you think you want. And more police officers do not translate into safer, less violent, reduced crime in the community. So these assumptions of if this, then that, must be interrupted and have to be investigated and interrogated. And then we have got to figure out how to communicate. How do people get this information who are not exactly our allies, who are not the people who will naturally say, yep, I understand that conversation, I want to be a part of it, because that is what the right has been so spectacularly successful at doing,
And that's, I think, the challenge with us in this defund the police conversation. I'd like to say that there's no impact to the Black Lives Matter movement because I think it's been pulled so separately from them. I'm afraid that that's not the case for the same reason we look at woke and how that's being weaponized against activists and African-American communities and people. But I'd like to hope that there's enough separateness that it's not going to be a truly impactful event for Black Lives Matter.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our topic is the national backlash against America's racial reckoning. Is conservative messaging putting woke to sleep?
Defund police was the headline. Where is it now? And how has it impacted the Black Lives Matter movement? I think we all know that following the elections in November, wherever there were attempts to encroach, defund the police, those attempts were defeated. And it might mean that the movement to, quote, defund the police received a heavy blow. The Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that continues regardless of any election result. Some have argued that the phrase defund the police was a poor one, that perhaps if the movement had chosen something other, such as reform the police or reimagine the police, that might have prevented the defeat of this movement that sought to change the way we are policed in our communities. The conservative movement would have used any phrase and turned it against the movement to change the way we do policing.
There's a little bit of a mixed bag when we're reflecting on the defund the police movement right now. Obviously, there were pretty major actions taken at the start, but since then we've seen some, I guess you could say, backsliding. For example, Portland, which cut millions from its police budget, is now working on hiring back a bunch of cops. Minneapolis voted down its potential measure to replace their police department with a Department of Public Safety. Some of that, I think, has to do definitely with a decrease in pressure over time. I think the 2020 election being a victory for the Democrats alleviated some of the pressure that progressives and their allies felt to put a lot of pressure on those types of things. But at the same time, there are alternate methods of public safety that have been able to gain ground and public acceptance as a result of defund the police. So as much as we can gripe about the naming of it, I think that Cecil is right in saying that whatever it was going to be called, it was going to be vilified by conservatives. And as with anything, no matter what the particular wording is, you got to interrogate it. What are they really trying to say? What defund the police was trying to say is, hey, police budgets have skyrocketed. No one's taking a close look at this, and the police are having a detrimental impact on communities. What if we try to fix this? One of the ways that we could fix it is not throwing more money at cops who are part of the problem. It is what it is, I guess, is what I would say about it. And that obviously, as I've talked a little bit about branding today and how progressives are perhaps not as adept as conservatives at branding, but that is also partially because progressives have ideas and things that they want to do that are new, as opposed to undoing things that have been done. Defund the police has had victories in the sense that there have been forays into alternate methods of public safety that have resulted in lives being saved. You just don't hear about them quite so much. And as far as how it's impacted the Black Lives Matter movement, I think that there has been a conflation of the two. And while they're bound together in many ways, Black Lives Matter, racial justice movements broadly extend beyond the police and extend to all of our oppressive systemic systems that exist that doesn't just touch the police. Black Lives Matter is a lot bigger than defund the police. Whether you find
defund the police to have been incredibly successful or an abject failure that doesn't reflect on the Black Lives Matter movement as a whole.
Professor Johnson, last question.
Defund the police was the headline. Where is it now, and how has it impacted the Black Lives Matter movement? Interesting discussion by the other panelists. And I would concede what Cecil said is correct, and also Althea. It wouldn't make any difference what it was. Conservatives' point would be to discredit it because it came from a point of view around policing. Defunding the police is ambiguous to me. That lack of clarity made it vulnerable to being twisted and recast as something that it was not. But I agree with the panelists that it wouldn't matter whether it was stated as defund the police or reimagine the police. There would have been a reaction from the conservative side. One of the things that's important is if we are trying to change an institution like policing, and it is important to remember that policing was to protect property. That was the start of the police department. It was not about serving people, it was about protecting property. This is a philosophical change that we've had over time. Some of the basic tenets of that still exist within the police department. If you want to make a change, you have to engage the people that you're trying to change. You have to engage the institution. If you say defund, that does not include that institution. That does not bring the police to the table to say, let's work this out. It was an unfortunate word choice. The actual intention of it is what's important. And that's something that I think people generally didn't understand because we just hang on the headlines and didn't look beyond it. And it did have an impact on Black Lives Matter because these two things were attached together. What Althea said is very important. The defund the police and Black Lives Matter, although they've been connected, Black Lives Matter is much bigger than just defunding the police. We also have issues with the justice system. We have issues with the correctional system. Black Lives Matter, to me, is about all these injustices, a much bigger platform than the focus on police. I do think it cost them some credits. In the long run, I believe Black Lives Matter gained legitimacy and will continue to be an important organization going forward.
Cecil, do you want to take us on home? Any final thoughts, Cecil? Because we lost you for a minute.
The fact that people might see the results of the 2021 elections as reason to be sad and soak and to be sorry, it means that we must continue to do the hard work. It isn't easy. There will be times when there are many people behind us, but often there will be times when there are no people behind us. Yet the struggle continues. And as Ted Kennedy said after he was defeated in the 1980 Democratic primaries, he said, the work continues, but the dream shall never die.
Been very successful. We have drastically reduced the crime rate.
7 years ago, Camden County, New Jersey had some of the highest crime rates in the nation, and leaders say public trust in police was almost zero.
So something had to change.
That's when County Director Louis Capelli Jr. and others decided to start over. to rebuild their police department from the ground up, with mostly new officers, new policies and training, and a focus on community.
Our officers now go through extensive training, and when they hit the street, they are given the task of knocking on doors in the neighborhood that they are serving to introduce themselves to the residents, to let them know, I'm a new officer, I'll be walking the beat or riding the bike in your neighborhood. If you need anything, let me know.
Officers now focus on de-escalating situations instead of using force. It's why Capelli says they've seen an 85% drop in excessive force complaints from the community.
We have thousands of fewer crime victims on a yearly basis, and the residents of our city are feeling much safer.
The only question is, will the same system that works for a community of 75,000 people work in Minneapolis?
Do you see this being successful in a city of this size?
I think some version of it can certainly be successful.
Capelli says the trick is to get community leaders on board and to always put the community first.
It's not a one-size-fits-all model, but the basic tenets behind our model is something that we think can apply to every police department.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on, let's talk about race, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Race.
Welcome back to Let's Talk About Race. At Let's Talk About Race, we wondered what was the most significant advancement toward human rights in the last 4 years. Our nominee was instrumental in exposing the truth that all Americans are not treated equally under the law. Our nominee exposed the corruption of privilege. Our nominee helped create truth, understanding, and empathy. Our nominee for the most significant advancement toward human rights in the United States and around the world is the camera phone. That's right, the camera phone. This piece of technology allowed human beings all around the world to witness the police being called on black people living their lives, being treated differently by law enforcement. The camera phone exposed the corruption of privilege and forever gave a new definition to the name Karen. The camera phone.
Sometimes listening to the news seems like one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we've created a new segment entitled Hope is a Thing with Feathers. What gives me hope during this news cycle is you have a famous rapper, Megan Thee Stallion. She went back to college and got her college degree.
I'm a savage, yeah. Classy, yeah. Bougie, yeah. Ratchet, yeah. Sassy, moody, yeah. Nasty, yeah. Hacking, yeah. Stupid, yeah. What's happening? What's up? What's happening?
I know we had a Black on Black crime show a few shows ago, and we talked about how there's an anti-intellectual thread in popular Black music. And to see a famous rapper, a popular rapper, get her college degree and then brag about it is an amazing thing.
I go to Texas Southern University, and I know you're probably gonna ask me, what am I studying? It's health administration. And everybody's always like, why isn't there like communications or music or something? Like, before I was like publicly rapping, I already knew what I wanted to do like as a career. So I didn't want to let music affect my school, and I didn't want to let school affect my music.
That is what gave me hope. Cecil, what gave you hope during this news cycle?
Things that gave me hope during this news cycle were the fact that many people are coming out of their shells, almost figuratively and literally, in terms of connecting with one another. And although this terrible health crisis we are in will continue for some time, I think the fact that people are getting vaccinated and that now children are eligible to be vaccinated, that gives me hope.
Thank you, Cecil. I want to go to Althea, Professor Johnson, and then end it with Mary Lee. What gave you hope?
I too was also heartened by the vaccine doses for kids being distributed. I know that that is a major relief for so many parents who have been, you know, in a really tough situation in this pandemic, unable to protect their kids in the way that older kids have been protected.
This is a fact. Cases are coming down. The proportion of cases that are children in this age group is actually increasing. And I'll even make a further point that we're going into a winter season. More people are going indoors. And we know that children are the most vulnerable because they are the lowest in terms of immunization. Children can also spread it to other members of the household. That's what usually happens when we see a household with positive cases. So we shouldn't let our guard down because our mitigation measures, putting the masks on, being indoors, have worked. And millions of students have also had to quarantine during this time, which has also helped to decrease cases. But we're trying to do this to get better population level immunity. Your child being safe, creating the community to be safe. So that's the fact behind the numbers. There is no long-term data because, as you point out, novel virus vaccines that were really based on technology that was decades old, so that's reassuring. But there is no trial that's longer than a year. However, we do have literally billions of people that have received vaccines around the world, adults, and then some children, and then we have the trials of children going on around the world. And what I will say is that any serious adverse effect we have started to see on average within 2 to 3 weeks. We will never have the answer for those, quote, long-term side effects for years. That's important, but you have to also weigh, what is the risk of my child or someone in my household or someone we know that could suffer from not just the bad effects of COVID, but some of the long-term consequences that we still don't understand, what we call long COVID syndrome. So it's a risk and benefit balance. Talk to your pediatrician. For me, my benefits outweighed the risk, so I vaccinated my children and recommend it to patients.
Another thing that came to mind for me, hope is a thing with feathers, kind of related to our topic today. This isn't super recent, but it is ongoing in Oregon, that non-unanimous juries have finally been abolished. One of the only two spots in the nation where that was still happening. And it came from a very racist and anti-Semitic place in Oregon in particular. And now there's been rulings that those who were convicted under a non-unanimous jury, meaning that even 12 people couldn't agree that they did the thing that they were on trial for, they can appeal for a new trial and potentially get out of the prison system as a result.
Professor Johnson, what gave you hope?
What gave me hope is the infrastructure bill being passed. I'm very excited about what this means. I am especially pleased that we're finally doing something with roads and bridges and that we're spending money on America. So we are putting America first. The airports, all of the public transit, I'm really pretty excited about that. And I'm hoping that we will be able to do the second bill with greater ease. Now, I may be optimistic because there's some wonderful things in the social structure bill. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed on that. But at least we got the logjam out of the way and we actually have this bill.
Mary Lee.
For me, as a Chinese American woman and the child of an immigrant, the election of Michelle Wu, let's call her name, Michelle Wu, Michelle Wu.
Well, good evening. So, one of my sons asked me the other night, if boys can be elected mayor in Boston. They have been, and they will again someday, but not tonight. On this day, Boston elected your mom, because from every corner of our city, Boston has spoken. We are ready to meet this moment. We are ready to become a Boston for everyone. We're ready to be a Boston that doesn't push people out, but welcomes all who call our city home. We're ready to be a Boston where all can afford to stay and to thrive. And yes, Boston is ready to become a Green New Deal city. Today at the polls, and over this last year, and over generations in this city, Boston has come together to reshape what is possible. We are the city of the first public school in the country, the first public park, the first subway tunnel in the country. We're the city of revolution, civil rights, marriage equality. Boston has always been that city that punches above our weight, where our activism, our community, our joy radiates out into progress across the country. And today, together, we are marching into Boston's promise. We stand here in the South End, on the edge of the Southwest Corridor. It is here where 52 years ago, there was a 12-lane highway planned. They said it was a done deal, that stopping it would be impossible. And for a while, that's how it seemed, until a coalition of activists from across our neighborhood stood up for people over highways. Some of them are here in this room, and they successfully fought for housing that was affordable, for an orange line instead of an interstate, for families then, and for families for generations to come. Our movement is a continuation of that activism and community, showing everyone what's possible when we all dig in and push for what we truly deserve. And what we deserve is a Boston where all of us are seen, heard, treasured, and valued. A Boston for everyone.
In Boston is not only phenomenal because of all of those identities, but it is also phenomenal because it is the first non-man, cisgendered, white person elected to lead that city. And I can only imagine how the core of strength inside of this person, how challenging her job is going to be, and how much everyone is going to have to be sending the love and the hands and everything to her as she moves through this wonderful experience.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on. Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News Northwest.
Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO's end of year drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to KBOO.FM slash